Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of The Ravencast. My name is Adam Erickson, and The Ravencast is a product of The Raven Review, where we explore family life, politics, pop culture, current events, violence, and nonviolence through the lens of mimetic theory. And in this episode of The Ravencast, I'm going to be talking with Cesario Bandera. Cesario is the author of many books, including The Sacred Game and A Refuge of Lies, Reflections on Faith and Fiction, and also The Humble Story of Don Quixote. And all I have is the book cover. I lost the book jacket long ago, so just this big red book, but it's a fascinating book, well worth your time. Check it out. We did this interview at the Colloquium on Violence and Religion, and when I saw Cesario there, I knew that I had to do an interview with him, because Cesario was a very early friend of René Girard, the founder of mimetic theory. And Cesario has been pretty open about many of the disagreements that he has had with René about his work. And one of the things that I wanted to ask Cesario about was how to have these kinds of big arguments about really important things in a way in which you can remain friends. Because oftentimes arguments turn into hostility, which ends friendships, but that didn't happen with them. So I wanted to explore that with Cesario. I also wanted to explore how Cesario differs with Girard when it comes to the origins of human culture. Also, where do we find hope amidst a world that seems to be going into more and more chaos? So we also talked about freedom and responsibility. And so I think you're going to enjoy this conversation with Cesario. But I want to give you a little bit of a warning ahead of time. We had some audio problems. We were told that the office that we were going to be filming in was going to be quiet and nobody would walk through. Well, wouldn't you know, as soon as we start recording, people are walking through, there are loud noises, people talking. So I had to do a little bit of editing that stuff out, but the conversation flows pretty well. And so I hope you enjoy this conversation with Cesario Bandera. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Colloquium on Violence and Religion. We are here in Spain, in Madrid, and I am here with Cesario Bandera. Hi, Cesario.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Okay.
We are
still standing.
You're still standing. That's good. We are in your hometown.
Well, not exactly.
We're in your home country.
In my home country, yeah. Yes. I'm from the south.
Okay.
I'm from Malaga.
Where is
Malaga?
That?
Malaga is straight south from Madrid.
Okay.
On the coast, and then you know.
Yeah.
Right across the Mediterranean from Africa.
So you grew up in Malaga?
No, actually, I was born there, but grew up in other parts of southern Spain.
Okay.
Like Cordoba and Sevilla, where I went into the law school to get a law degree, which I never practiced.
Yeah.
And then I got married and we went to the US.
Okay. And so you got a law degree?
Yes.
But you never practiced it?
No.
So you've written a book on Don Quixote?
Yes.
Did you get a degree in literature?
Yes, yes. We went as graduate students to Cornell. Kind of teaching assistantship there, and so eventually after several trials I ended up studying Spanish literature.
Okay.
At Cornell.
Yeah.
Of all places.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And eventually you met René Girard.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, the director of my dissertation, which was a famous medievalist, was a good friend, personal friend of Girard. They had both been at Johns Hopkins.
Mm.
And As I said, he was at Cornell at the time, was directing my dissertation. He knew my intellectual leanings, so he said, oh, you must meet this friend of mine who have just written a book, which was Manson Romantique, which you will love. So it just happened that at the time, Girard was in ready to accept an offer from SUNY Buffalo. And in fact, he moved from Johns Hopkins to SUNY Buffalo in 68. I happened to have an offer from Buffalo too, at approximately the same time, so I followed him to Buffalo the following year in 69. We met for the first time in 69. And it was, I would like to say love at first sight, maybe that's not probably the proper thing to say.
Friendship at first sight?
I'm sorry?
Friendship at first sight?
Friendship at first sight. Yeah. Yes, I mean, yeah. we connected. Yeah. We connected.
What was it about Rene that you connected with so quickly?
His ideas. It was, he talked about Don Quixote.
Yeah.
And, you know, I said, yes, immediately. Yes, that's it.
Yeah.
That's it. You're right. I think the same thing about Don Quixote. Then we disagreed on other things, you know, and we had discussions about everything.
Yeah.
But basically, you know, there was a general worldview, mm-hmm. I would say. Those were very difficult times, all over the place, but particularly in American universities. We're talking, in Europe it was the summer of 68, you know, big movements in Paris. At Cornell, things had happened, you know, where people had revolutionaries, academic revolutionaries, so to speak, who even tried to burn the library down, who took over Willard State Hall, which housed the student union and other services of the university, and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It was very trying times where university faculties were simply caught up, very cowardly, I should say, but not Girard.
No.
Not Girard. Girard never gave way to any kind of crowd pressure. You know, he's, in other words, he always suspected the crowd.
Yeah.
You know, and the old saying in Latin, vox populi, vox dei. Yes, he said literally, but this is why you should never trust the populace, the crowd, the big crowd. He never did. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the extremely few people who, in a very serene way, did not.
What do you think it was about him that was able to resist the crowd?
I don't know. I think it was sheer intellectual honesty.
Yeah.
He thought that those things that were happening were wrong. That it was the power of the crowd all over the place. It was so. I could tell you many instances which are not going to go into.
Yeah.
But I knew personally that most of these things were manipulated by people who remained in the shadows and you know, moved crowds around, taking occupying things, etc., etc. Sometimes going a little bit overboard, like, you know, in some cases they succeeded in burning things down.
Yeah.
And faculty just yielded.
Yeah.
You know, if they asked for whatever, they were afraid.
They were afraid.
It was an extraordinary power of the crowd, you know?
Yeah.
He did. And
takes a lot of strength to not go with the crowd. It also takes, as you say, intellectual honesty, because you quoted the voice of the crowd is the voice of God.
Yes.
Right? And it's often hard to distinguish between the two.
Yeah, but he knew
they're both very
that
powerful.
That God was a very archaic God. You see, that's one of the things I remember, from my study of law was we all had to study Roman law, and Spanish or Italian, French. I don't know so much about French. But Italian and Spanish, you have to study Roman law. And in Roman law, when everything failed, you were asking for justice, and the judge would not pay attention to you, or you did not have some noble patrician supporting you, you still had a final recourse, the force of the crowd. And he had a name, provocatio. Provocation means you, which literally means the calling of people for something.
Yeah.
And even the highest patrician noble in Rome gave in. The power of the crowd was, ultimately, the ultimate, the supreme court of the society was the crowd.
Let's move to Christ, because Christ plays an important role for you and also for Girard.
Yes.
And you're reminding me of when the crowd chants crucify him and Pilate relents. And
exactly.
So this is what Roman
exactly.
was.
Exactly.
The voice of the crowd is the voice
yes.
of God.
Yes.
Talk about the role of Christ in your thinking.
Well, let me say that I never had any doubts about my Christianity. On the other hand, another reason I admired René Girard is because I knew he told me, and I heard from other sources, about his conversion. And a sincere conversion is something to be reckoned with. Vincent Romantique, he told me, was really a result. I mean, he would not have written that book, which really projected him into big name, big time in the literary critical world, without his conversion. I never had that kind of experience, but that's another thing that I admired. And he was able to see that in the text that he studied. So he simply reinforced my Christian convictions, which I always had, but they were not at the deeply personal level that he experienced them. But these things that I am criticizing today, I admired profoundly when they came about. And because I knew that he was doing those things out of a very deeply Christian conviction. His anthropological project, to me was, and to many others, but not everybody, was immediately related to Christianity. It became immediately obvious to me, this is a scientific demonstration of Christ's sacrifice. To me that was, it didn't amount to a conversion, all of a sudden, he brought Christ increasingly to the center of my intellectual life. In fact, I was ready for that. Because before I knew him, the doctoral thesis that I wrote was on this historical epic hero. I mean, historical and poetic epic of Spain called El Cid. An 11th century warrior, Castilian warrior. It was the first major work in Spanish literature. I had discovered, or I thought that I saw, a kind of Christian, in other words, that the poet was trying to present not just a typical medieval hero, but Christian one. A Christian one who fought. He said many times, we have no other way. If we had any other way in the world to live without fighting, I would not fight. But if we want to survive, and I have to take care of my vassals, many of them, we have to fight. And he even accepted, you see, the enemy, the Moors, they said explicitly, when they said they are coming here, there's an army coming from all of us. They have a right to do so. We have attacked them, we have raided their fields, they have a right to do so. All of that, to me, amounted to a deliberate poetic effort on part of the poet to present this epic hero, which may or may not have been as Christian as he says, but I was analyzing the poem. Clearly, a Christian hero. That was frowned upon or suspected. It was not easy for me to publish that. Eventually it was published. But in a way in which even the publisher said, okay, the critics will take care of it. In other words, a little bit like, okay, I'm going to do it, but I'm washing my hands of this affair. For me, it was also a refuge. Because, he understood immediately what I was trying to say, and he said yes.
Because he was taking Christ seriously on an intellectual level, too. And you were talking about academia and all of these things that are happening, and one of the things that Gerard and yourself get criticized for is for taking Christ seriously in the academic world.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have tried, I did try on a couple of occasions to talk with publishers in Spain. I offered myself, I could translate this book. This is important. We ought to have this book in Spanish. And usually I got, to put it in the words of one of the people who rejected it. It has a kind of theological smell.
Yeah.
And that bothers me.
Yeah.
So that was another way in which I connected with
you guys. Bonded.
Absolutely. Because he was finding the same kind of hostility to religion in general, but particularly Christian. And all of a sudden, for a guy to say, you all of you people, all of you, you are wrong. Religion is at the center of everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You cannot understand anything unless you take religion seriously.
Yeah.
That's the secret of everything.
But religion and the cross, seriously.
Yes,
the cross is what people often don't like about Jesus.
Yes,
So you've been talking about your friendship with Rene, and you started off by saying you had deep friendship with Rene, but also arguments. And this is one of the things that I think should be highlighted, because oftentimes now arguments just turn into hostility.
No.
And it ends friendships. But you were able to model
with
a
us.
Way with Rene.
Not with us.
Where you could argue with one another very seriously.
Very seriously. That doesn't mean that he took that he paid attention, but that I made him change his mind.
Yes.
But he used to say, half jokingly, Cesario is too tough for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
too tough for you.
He said that, that I was too tough for him.
Yeah.
In a way, I was. There were things that bothered me from the beginning. As I mentioned in the paper, even while I realized the enormous potential that his anthropological view of the sacrificial crisis and the enormous potential, I mean, he was explaining Christ on the cross. But at the same time, his insistence, and he was adamant about it, that that had completely independent from Christ.
I remember in your paper you said that it's an attempt to explain Christ scientifically without Christ.
That's it. He thought, this is the irony of the situation, that he did this out of his Christian faith. This is the irony. He truly thought that if he could do it without even mentioning God, without even mentioning Christ, it would be better for Christ. Because it would be saying, this is pure 100% science that says the same thing. Which it did. But he didn't read the other side of the coin.
Uh-huh.
All right, if you can do it without Christ, why do we need Christ?
That's the question. One of the other things that I've often struggled with mimetic theory that you talk about in Refuge of Lives as well, is that humans were formed out of violence, out of sacrifice. It always seemed to me, it was a scandal for me because of the Genesis account. And I wanted to find some way to say that the world is good, that humans are good. But it just seemed like if it was created out of violence, humanity, that's not good.
No, indeed, indeed, you know. Yes, and that was one of the first objections.
Yeah. Tell me about how you worked that through and solved that in Refuge of Lives.
It was hard.
Yeah.
In other words, I never accepted the premise that everything begins out of the scapegoat mechanism.
Okay.
You know, that is not the beginning. The beginning cannot be violence. You know, the human beings are not essentially violent. If you believe that they are God's creatures, and if you believe in them, that God is good, that God is not a Jupiter or something like that, if you believe in the Christian God, you cannot believe that men, human beings are from birth, you know, originally bad and violent creatures. No. I'm not sure that he believed that either.
Mm.
But anyhow, he did not have a scientific answer for that.
Mm.
Father Schwager, who pointed that out to him also, tried to remedy the situation. I had the feeling that Father Schwager did not press the case strong enough with Schwager. Wolfgang Palaver, with whom I was talking yesterday, believes that, oh yes, he did, he tried. He was Father's. I never got that impression, nor did I get that impression from René, who acknowledged that Father Schwager was saying something that he had to give an answer for. But he never thought that he had to change anything fundamental. As far as he was concerned, as far as his theory was concerned, the beginning was the fall.
Mm.
As he told Stella Barbieri in one of his, I don't remember what book it was. You know, there is no other man but fallen man. We don't know of any other. Well, it is true. Paradise disappeared. You know, there are no traces of that. But we cannot. But what I am trying to say is that his own theory of the scapegoat, of the sacrificial crisis, which ends up because man is capable of turning his own violence into a god via the victim. That the very idea of sacralizing, the very idea of the sacred, the very idea of seeing something as a god presupposes that there has been a previous contact. We may never recover, we will never recover that contact, but that contact was there. Not only that, but if that contact was there, in other words, every theologian will tell you, whatever that man in paradise we can imagine, but there was a closeness, you know. It was a creature that all of a sudden emerges out of animality, out of whatever you want. Sure or not. You know, the law of evolution may have played a, you know, a role there. You know, it does not eliminate the scientific part of it, you know. But at a point, there is an emergence of something totally new, a consciousness which sees everything in the light of something else. You know? And we believe that something else was gone. Not a violent thing, but precisely the thing that is present all over. That paradise must have been just that. You know, you look around and there is the invisible God is naturally visible all over the place. Mm-hmm. If you posit that, you can only posit that. It explains perfectly the sacralization of violence. When you see God, then the Bible will tell you from the beginning, from the murder of Abel by Cain, and subsequent violence, it tells you clearly that what is at stake there is the sign of God, the image of God in man. This is what mimetic design is all about, right? It is the image of God in the other. The Bible tells you this led to a universal flood of violence.
You get the apocalyptic flood of violence in chapter 6.
Exactly. What was at stake was the image of God. Therefore, you can also understand what Christ said, or the prophet said for Christ, he will open his mouth and spill out things that when he was there, in the middle of the virus, it was because of him that they could find the victim, sacralize, turn the victim into a god who saved them. Mm-hmm. Saved them. It was terrible.
Yeah.
It was terrible, but it saved them and it planted the seed that will eventually redeem them in Christ. But as Peter said in his letter, Christ and as the prophet said, was there in the beginning.
Yeah.
He became manifest later for your sake, but he was destined from the beginning.
The other part about that is Christ says in Matthew 25 that he's, where is he? He lies with those who are victims of human culture. He identifies, that's where
of
he
course,
Christ,
of course,
right?
Yes.
So at the very beginning, where is Christ in all of this?
He's in the victim, in that victim. Totally arbitrary, totally selected at random.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it was.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
In mimetic theory, there's a big discussion about freedom.
Yes.
And you were saying earlier, I think this is important, that the freedom that we have is the freedom to choose which model
okay.
to follow.
Yeah, but, okay, I did not want to press my case there because it may have been misunderstood. But yes, you are absolutely right. As I say in my paper, it is because God created man as a free agent that the whole notion of incarnation and the whole notion of redemption makes sense.
Mm.
In other words, if men are not free, they are not redeemed. redeemable either, because they are not guilty of anything.
Mm, right.
They are not free. So they are really free to extinguish themselves from the face of the earth.
Mm, yes.
They are free to go to hell, yeah. Literally, you know.
Yeah.
So, but what gives them, if that is true, then how do they stand before God? Did God defeat the devil, Satan, by overpowering Satan? No. No. You know? But God, instead of calling a legion of angels to destroy everything, gives himself into the hands of those people. You know, he becomes the victim. That's their freedom. Now, from that moment on, they will learn to be, not to be crushed by guilt, in other words, because you have to take the religious language seriously. He takes the sins of the world on himself. That is not simply a transfer thing. It is simply that unless you liberate archaic man from the crushing weight of his guilt, he has sacralized guilt. Terrified by the deity because the deity is pointing at him in a hostile way, which means they are guilty in the face of that. You know, this is God's error. He didn't see that. He cried, if Christ simply came to say, listen, humans, this is what you have been, this is how bad you have been. My God,
yeah.
You see,
it's just guilt.
Yeah.
You're
telling them the reason why they were slaved by their fake god that they created, because you know guilt was overpowering.
Mm-hmm.
You have to take the guilt away so that they can repent. You know, transform, it's a total transformation to a responsible guilt. Mm-hmm. This is what they are taking out. And that's another reason why I had strong arguments with Girard many, many years ago. He, when he studied Greek tragedy, his theory was basically Sophocles and particularly Euripides, but you know, even all the tragedians really, they get very close to the truth. The truth being not just one somebody killed the father of Oedipus, you know, but many, you know, all. In other words, the idea that there is just one guy responsible for everything is not true. This is Girard saying the tragedians get very close to. But as it gets closer and closer to the truth, it's going to get closer to the abyss. Because when you get there and you see your guilt, you're crushed immediately. Because you have found the sacred, and the sacred overpowers you and reduces you to nothing. So they did not dare go into that. But now Christ comes. And Christ is far more courageous, and he goes all the way and shows. And I said, René, no, that doesn't work. This getting close to the truth in order to immediately retreat, it's a whole ritualistic process.
Mm-hmm.
How do you remind everybody that you should beware of the sacred. Get close to it. Get as close to it as you can, and you will see how everybody gets back. That is not getting close to Christ at all. You see, Simone Weil had this problem. She was a great admirer of the Greeks and so forth. So for her, she saw the Iliad, pretty much as Girard saw the tragedians. You know, for Simone Weil, the Iliad is the precursor of Christ. There's no way. I mean, they didn't understand this. So I had strong arguments with Renee in this year. There was also disagreement with regard to the Quixote himself. You know. Those were not really substantive. There were more disagreements in perspective. You can look at this perspective of this other, and think that one is more appropriate than the other, you know. But yes, we did have arguments, sometimes pretty heated. And when he said, you know, I attended when I could his lectures, of course, and he would normally come to me and he would look at me and say, asking me, how do you do, you know? And sometimes I said, good. But occasionally I said, horrible. Horrible. I mean, you didn't make sense.
Yeah.
You got things confused.
When you would have these heated debates, what was it that, I'm just still interested, well, how did you remain friends?
Because, you know, well.
I would see that people who are on this intellectual level would see it as maybe an insult or.
Well, this is why he was such an extraordinary human being, you know. I mean, he's, on a personal level, believe me, he was on the way to sainthood.
Yeah.
Really, you know, I mean, there is a group of people I hear that are even today trying to get Chesterton canonized, you know. I talked about that, you know, at Girard's funeral in, you know, last year or 2 years ago. And he said, well, if I had to propose somebody for canonization, for beatification, I would nominate Girard. Because on a personal level, you know, he was not a man easily offended by anything. He could disagree strongly. But he did not take things personally, you know. Before he would do that, he simply shut up, turn, you know, and walk away. But he will not. He will not answer a challenge, you know, or an insult, or anything like that. He would rather remain silent.
He practiced turning the other cheek.
Yeah, well, I don't know if he. Turn the other cheek. We never got that far.
Yeah, okay.
But yes, he simply knew when not to continue.
He has statements in his book where he'll say stuff like, I don't remember exactly what it is, but the future of our world depends on us dropping all violence, dropping all rivalry.
Yes. The thing is that it's not going to happen. You know, in other words, not without Christ's help.
Yeah.
You know, but ultimately, eventually, this very notion that we are lost without Christ, we as Christians must believe that we'll be seeping in deeper and deeper and deeper until eventually the truth will shine, you know, and nobody can deny it. It may be 2,000 years from now, or heaven knows when. But this is totally different from what he proposes in Asherville Clausewitz. There, the responsibility is on us. We have to look at the abyss. We stand it, and if we can do that, then Christ will show up. Oh my God. If that is the case, we're lost.
We're lost.
This is why we couldn't do it.
So if that is the case, we're lost. What is the hope?
The hope is in Christ.
Yeah.
The hope is that he will not, as he said, I will remain with you to the end of the world. And we hope that is our hope. There is no other hope.
Okay. Yeah. I think we're going to have to leave it there, because I think my battery just died on my phone, but I think the camera is still going. Cesario, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Having this conversation.
It was a pleasure.
Yes. Okay. And thanks, everybody, for watching. If you want to stay up to date on all things related to the Colloquium on Violence and Religion, you can check out the website at religionandviolence.org. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.